A hero in the rearview mirror. Sometimes it takes time and distance to realize the value of life's important lessons. Clay, 416, might provide a counterpart of Marlon Brando's classic statement in On the Waterfront, "I could have been a contender." Clay, 416, might have said, "I could have been a hero." However, in the heat of the moment, he was thought to be just a troublemaker who caused hardships to his fellows, a rebel without an obvious cause. Heroism often requires social support. We typically celebrate heroic deeds of courageous individuals, but we do not do so if their actions have tangible, immediate cost to the rest of us, and we can't understand their motives. Such heroic seeds of resistance are best sown if all members of a community share a willingness to suffer for common values and goals. We have seen such an instance, for example, in Nelson Mandela's resistance to apartheid when he was imprisoned in South Africa. Networks of people in many European nations organized escapes and hideouts for Jews to survive the Nazi Holocaust. Hunger strikes were employed for political purposes in the fasting to death of IRA leaders during their imprisonment in Belfast's Longkesh prison. They and others from the Irish National Liberation Army used the hunger strike to gain attention to their status as political prisoners instead of being designated as ordinary criminals. More recently, hundreds of detainees being held in the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo, Cuba, have gone on extended hunger strikes to protest the illegal and inhumane nature of their captivity and gain media attention to their cause. As for Clay, 416, although he had a personal plan for effective resistance, he did not take time to share it with his cellmates or the other prisoners so that they could decide to join forces with him. Had he done so, his plan might have represented a unifying principle rather than being dismissed as a personal pathology. It would have become a collective challenge to the evil system rather than a dispositional quirk. Perhaps because he came on the scene late, the other prisoners did not know him well enough or felt that he had not paid his dues as they had during those first hard days and nights. In any case, he was an outsider, as Dave, our informer, replacement for 8612, had been. Though Dave had been quickly won over to the prisoner's side and aligned with their cause against the system that had hired him as its spy, not so with 416. However, I think it was also 416's introverted style that was alienating his fellows. He was used to going it alone, living his life in his own complex mind and not in the realm of interpersonal connections. Nevertheless, his defiance had a powerful impact on the thinking of at least one other prisoner, albeit after the prison experience was over. Jerry, 5486, the prisoner recently designated a smart aleck by the parole board, was clearly influenced by 416's heroism in the face of harsh abuse. "I was impressed with Clay's stoic determination and wish he would have been there from the beginning. He would have had a definite effect on the events that followed." In his later reflections, 5486 added, "It was interesting that when Clay, 416, who was the first real example of an obstinate person who had made up his mind when he absolutely refused to eat his sausages, people went against him. Earlier in the study, he would have been their ideal. Because a lot of people said they were going to be hard and fast and strike and all this, but when it finally came around to somebody having the guts to do that, they went against him. They wanted their own petty little comforts rather than see him hold on to his integrity." Jerry, 5486, went on to note how unpleasant it was to witness the clash between 416 and 7258, between Hubby and Clay over the sausages and the girlfriend. Later on, he had a better perspective on the true meaning of that confrontation. But he could not see the true nature of the event while it was unfolding, and he could have taken action to intervene and defuse it. "I realized that everybody was so far into the whole thing that they were suffering and making others suffer as well. It was too sad to see them go through it, especially since Hubby didn't realize that If he had not gotten to see his girl, it would be John Wayne's fault, not Clay's. Hubby took the bait and let it tear him apart. Meanwhile, back in solitary confinement, Clay, 416, was coping in a kind of Buddhist style that would have made Paul, 5704, proud of him, had he known that Clay was using such a Zen-like tactic for mental survival. I meditated constantly. For example, when I was refusing dinner, the guard, Burdan, has all the prisoners out of their cells trying to convince me that Visitor's Day was going to be canceled and all this shit, which I calculated wouldn't happen. But I wasn't sure. I just had calculated that probability. I then continually stared at the droplet of water from the Frankfurter that was glistening on my tin plate. I just stared at that droplet and focused myself first horizontally, then vertically. Nobody was then able to bother me. I had a religious experience in the hole. This scrawny kid had found inner peace through his passive resistance, taking control over his body and directing himself away from the guards. Clay, 416, offered this moving account of how he believed that he had won the contest of personal will against institutional power. Once I refused food before the dominant evening guard, I became content for the first time here. It pleased me to infuriate Guard Hellman. Upon being thrown in the hole for the night, I was jubilant. Jubilant because I felt all but sure that I had exhausted his resources to be used against him. I was astonished to realize, too, that I had privacy in solitary confinement. It was luxurious. His punishment of the others did not concern me. I was gambling on the limits of the situation. I knew, I calculated, that visitors' privileges could not be removed. I prepared myself to stay in the hole until probably 10 the next morning. In the hole, I was furthest from experiencing myself as Clay. I was 416, willing and proud even to be 416. The number had an identity to me because 416 had found his own response to the situation. I felt no need to cling to the former manhood I had under my old name. In the hole, there's a 4-inch bar of light extending top to bottom, thrown by the crack between the closet doors. About the third hour there, I was filled with calm in regarding this bar of light. It is the most beautiful thing in the prison. I don't mean that only subjectively. It is. Go look at it. When I was released around 11 p.m. and returned to a bed, I felt that I had won, that my will, so far, was stronger than the will of the situation as a whole. I slept well that night. The sidekick shows a little soul. Kurt Banks tells me that of all the guards, the one he likes or respects least is Burdan, because he is such a little toady, sucking up after Hellman, living in the big guy's wake. I am feeling the same, although from a prisoner's point of view there were others who were much worse threats to their sanity and survival. One of the staff had overheard Burdan bragging that he had seduced his friend's wife last night. The three of them had been regular weekly bridge players, and although he had always been attracted to this 28-year-old mother of two children, he had never had the guts to move on her. Until now. Perhaps it was his newfound sense of authority that gave him the courage to deceive and cuckold his old friend. If it were true, it was another reason not to like him. Then we found in his background information that his mother escaped from Nazi Germany, so we add some positive weight back into our evaluation of this complex young man. Burdan's shift report is an amazingly accurate depiction of official corrections staff behavior. We have a crisis in authority. This rebellious conduct, 416 is fasting, potentially undermines the complete control we have over the others. I have gotten to know the idiosyncrasies of various numbers. Interesting that he calls them numbers, a blatant de-individualization of the prisoners. I attempt to utilize this information only for harassment while inside the cell block. He also points the finger at the lack of support he and the other guards were getting from our staff. Real trouble started at dinner. We looked to prison authority to find out how to handle this late revolt for the reason that we're worried about him not eating. They are strangely absent. We plead guilty to not providing oversight and training. My negative view of Guard Burdan is tempered by what he did next. I can't stand the idea of him, 416, being in the hole any longer, he says. It seems dangerous, since the rules limit solitary to 1 hour. I argue with Dave and then quietly put the new prisoner, 416, back in his cell. He adds, but with a touch of malice, I order him to take the sausages to bed with him. A validation of this positive take on Burdan comes from a comment by Jerry, 5486, who was the only prisoner to volunteer to give up his blanket for Clay, 416. I was upset at John Wayne's ranting and raving. Burdan came over to my cell, knowing I sympathized with Clay, and said that he won't be kept in there all night. We'll bring him out as soon as everyone is asleep, he whispered to me, and then went back to pretending he was a hard guy. It was as if he needed to make some honest, sincere communication in the eye of the storm. Not only was Jerry 5486 in 416's corner, but he also came to feel that the best thing about this whole experience was meeting Clay. Seeing one guy who knew what he wanted and was willing to endure whatever necessary to get it. He was the only guy with anything at stake who didn't sell out or plead or crack up. In that night's shift report, Burdan notes, there's no solidarity between the remaining prisoners, with the exception of 5486, who has always demanded equal privileges for all. I concur. That is one reason for respecting Jerry, 5486, more than any of the other prisoners. This intense, extended experience is enriching my appreciation of the complexity of human nature. Because just when you think you understand someone, you realize you know only the smallest slice of their inner nature, derived from a limited set of personal or mediated contacts. As I, too, come to respect Clay, 416, for his willpower in the face of such strong opposition, I discover that he is not all Buddha. He tells us in his final interview what he thinks about the suffering his hunger strike caused the other prisoners. If I am trying to get out and the guards create a situation where it is difficult on other people because I'm trying to get out, I don't give a shit. His friend, Jerry, 5486, provides a fascinating perspective on the complex mind games that he was playing and losing in this prison. More and more as the experiment went on, I could justify my actions by saying, it's only a game, and I know it, and I can endure it easy enough, and they can't bother my mind, so I'll go through the actions. Which was fine for me. I was enjoying things, counting my money and planning my escape. I felt my head was pretty together, and they couldn't upset me, because I was detached from it all, watching it happen. But I realize now that no matter how together I thought I was inside my head, my prison behavior was often less under my control than I realized. No matter how open, friendly, and helpful I was with other prisoners, I was still operating as an isolated, self-centered person, being rational rather than compassionate. I got along fine in my own detached way, but now I'm aware that frequently my actions hurt others. Instead of responding to their needs, I would assume that they were as detached as I, and thereby rationalize my own selfish behavior. The best example of this was when Clay, 416, was in the closet with his sausages. Clay and I were friends. He knew I was on his side during the fasting incident, and I felt I had helped him some at the supper table when the other prisoners were trying to make him eat. But when he went in the closet and we were told to yell things and pound on the door, I did it, just like everyone else. I easily justified it by saying, it's just a game. Clay knows I'm on his side. My actions don't make any difference, so I'll just keep humoring the guard. Later, I realized that the yelling and pounding was really hard on Clay. There I was, tormenting the guy I liked most, and justifying it by saying, I'll go through the motions, but they haven't got control of my mind. When what was really important was the other guy's mind. What was he thinking? How were my actions affecting him? I was blind to the consequences of my actions and unconsciously assigning the responsibility for them to the guards. I had separated my mind from my actions. I probably would have done anything short of causing physical harm to a prisoner, as long as I could shift the responsibility to the guards. And so now I think maybe you can't separate mind and actions as clearly as I did during the experiment. I prided myself on how unassailable my mind was. I didn't get upset. I didn't let them control my mind. But as I look back on the things I did, it seems they had quite a strong but subtle control over my mind. What you are doing to those boys is a terrible thing. The last toilet run of Thursday night started at 10 p.m. Christina had been working at the library following her quiet stint earlier on the parole and disciplinary board. She had come down to the prison for the first time to pick me up to drive over to the Town and Country Mall near campus for a late dinner at Stickney's restaurant. I was in my superintendent's office going over some logistics for the next day's mass interviews. I saw her chatting with one of the guards, and when she finished, I motioned her to have a seat near my desk. She later described her unusual encounter with that particular guard. In August of 1971, I had just completed my doctorate at Stanford University, where I was the office mate of Craig Haney, and was preparing to start my new job as an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Relevant background also should include mention that I had recently gotten involved romantically with Phil Zimbardo, and we were even considering the possibility of marriage. Although I had heard from Phil and other colleagues about the plans for their prison simulation study, I had not participated in either the preparatory work or the initial days of the actual simulation. Ordinarily, I would have been more interested and maybe become involved in some way. But I was in the process of moving, and my focus was on preparing for my first teaching job. However, I agreed when Phil asked me, as a favor, to help conduct some interviews with the study participants. When I went downstairs to the basement location of the prison, I then went to the other end of the hall where the guards entered the yard. There was a room outside the yard entrance, which the guards used to rest and relax when not on duty, or to change into or out of their uniforms at the start or end of their shifts. I talked to one of the guards there who was waiting to begin his shift. He was very pleasant, polite and friendly, surely a person anyone would consider a really nice guy. Later on, one of the research staff mentioned to me that I should take a look at the yard again, because the new late-night guard shift had come on, and this was the notorious John Wayne shift. John Wayne was the nickname for the guard who was the meanest and toughest of them all. His reputation had preceded him in various accounts I had heard. Of course, I was eager to see who he was and what he was doing that attracted so much attention. When I looked through the observation point, I was absolutely stunned to see that there John Wayne was the really nice guy with whom I had chatted earlier. Only now, he was transformed into someone else. He not only moved differently, but he talked differently, with a southern accent. He was yelling and cursing at the prisoners as he made them go through the count, going out of his way to be rude and belligerent. It was an amazing transformation from the person I had just spoken to, a transformation that had taken place in minutes, just by stepping over the line from the outside world into that prison yard. With his military-style uniform, billy club in hand, and dark silver-reflecting sunglasses to hide his eyes, this guy was an all-business, no-nonsense, really mean prison guard. Just then, I watched the last toilet-run chain gang parading past the open door of my superintendent's office. As usual, their ankle chains were linked from inmate to inmate. Big paper bags covered their heads, each prisoner's arm holding on to the shoulder of the one before him. A guard, big Jeff Landry, led the procession. "Chris, look at this," I exclaimed. She looked up, then right down. "Did you see that? What do you think?"
I already saw it.
And she looked away again. I was shocked by her seeming indifference. What do you mean? Don't you understand that this is a crucible of human behavior? We are seeing things no one has witnessed before in such a situation. What's the matter with you? Kurt and Jaffe also joined me against her. She couldn't reply because she was so emotionally distressed. Tears ran down her cheeks.
I'm leaving. Forget dinner. I'm going home.
I ran out after her, and we argued on the front steps of Jordan Hall, home of the psychology department. I challenged whether she could ever be a good researcher if she was going to get so emotional from a research procedure. I told her that dozens of people had come down to this prison, and no one had reacted as she had. She was furious. She didn't care if everyone in the world thought that what I was doing was okay. It was simply wrong. Boys were suffering. As principal investigator, I was personally responsible for their suffering. They were not prisoners, not experimental subjects, but boys, young men, who were being dehumanized and humiliated by other boys who had lost their moral compass in this situation. Her recollection of this intense confrontation is filled with gems of wisdom and compassion. But at that time, it was a slap in my face, the wake-up call from the nightmare that I had been living day and night for the past week. Christina recollects,
at around 11 p.m., the prisoners were being taken to the toilet prior to going to bed. The toilet was outside the confines of the prison yard, and this had posed a problem for the researchers, who wanted the prisoners to be in prison 24 hours a day, just as in a real prison. They did not want the prisoners to see people and places in the outside world, which would have broken the total environment they were trying to create. So the routine for the bathroom runs was to put paper bags over the prisoners' heads so they couldn't see anything, chain them together in a line, and lead them down the hall into, around, and out of a boiler room, and then to the bathroom and back. It also gave the prisoners an illusion of a great distance between the yard and the toilet, which was in fact only in a hallway around the corner.
Christina continues her recollection of that fateful night's reality confrontation.
When the bathroom run took place that Thursday evening, Phil excitedly told me to look up from some report I had been reading. Quick, quick, look at what's happening now. I looked at the line of hooded, shuffling, chained prisoners with guards shouting orders at them, and then quickly averted my gaze. I was overwhelmed by a chilling, sickening feeling. Do you see that? Come on, look. It's amazing stuff. I couldn't bear to look again, so I snapped back with, I already saw it. That led to a bit of a tirade by Phil and other staff there about what was the matter with me. Here was fascinating human behavior unfolding, and I, a psychologist, couldn't even look at it? They couldn't believe my reaction, which they may have taken to be a lack of interest. Their comments and teasing made me feel weak and stupid, the out-of-place woman in this male world, in addition to already feeling sick to my stomach by the sight of these sad boys so totally dehumanized.
She recalls our clash and its resolution.
A short while later, after we had left the prison setting, Phil asked me what I thought about the entire study. I'm sure he expected some sort of great intellectual discussion about the research and the events we had just witnessed. Instead, what he got was an incredibly emotional outburst from me. I am usually a rather contained person. I was angry and frightened and in tears. I said something like, what you are doing to those boys is a terrible thing. What followed was a heated argument between us. That was especially scary for me, because Phil seemed to be so different from the man I thought I knew, someone who loves students and cares for them in ways that were already legendary at the university. He was not the same man that I had come to love. Someone who is gentle and sensitive to the needs of others, and surely to mine. We had never had an argument before of this intensity. Instead of being close and in tune with each other, we seem to be on opposite sides of some great chasm. Somehow the transformation in Phil, and in me as well, and the threat to our relationship was unexpected and shocking. I don't remember how long the fight went on, but I felt it was too long and too traumatic. What I do know is that eventually Phil acknowledged what I was saying, apologized for his treatment of me, and realized what had been gradually happening to him and everyone else in the study, that they had all internalized a set of destructive prison values that distanced them from their own humanitarian values. And at that point, he owned up to his responsibility as creator of this prison, and made the decision to call the experiment to a halt. By then it was well past midnight, so he decided to end it the next morning, after contacting all the previously released prisoners, and calling in all the guard shifts for a full round of debriefings of guards, prisoners, and then everyone together. A great weight was lifted from him, from me, and from our personal relationship.
Your male camels, now hump them. I returned to the dungeon relieved and even exhilarated by the decision to abort the mission. I couldn't wait to share the news with Kurt Banks, who had done yeoman's duty servicing the video patrol at various times of the day and night, despite having a family to tend to as well. He, too, was delighted and told me that he was going to recommend ending the study as soon as possible after what he had witnessed while I was gone. We were sorry Craig was not here tonight to share our endgame joy. The calm demeanor displayed by Clay, 416, after what should have been a stressful ordeal, has angered Hellman. He cascades into a 1 a.m. count to end all counts. The sad, dwindling cadre of only 5 remaining prisoners, 416, 2093, 5486, 5704, and 7258, wearily lines up against the wall to recite their numbers, rules, and songs. No matter how well they do their chores, someone is punished in various ways. They are yelled at, cursed, and made to say abusive things to each other. "Tell him he's a prick," yells Hellman, and one prisoner turns to say that to the next. Then the sexual harassment that started to bubble up last night resumes as testosterone flows freely in every direction. Hellman shouts out to all of them, "See that hole in the ground? Now do 25 push-ups. Fuck in that hole. You hear me?" One after another, the prisoners obey, as Burdan shoves them down to do their duty. After a brief consultation between John Wayne and his little sidekick, Burdan, a new sexual game is devised. "Okay, now pay attention. You three are going to be female camels. Get over here and bend over, touching your hands to the floor." When they do, their naked butts are exposed, since they are wearing no underwear beneath their smock dresses. Hellman continues with obvious glee. "Now, you two, you're male camels. Stand behind the female camels and hump them." Burdan giggles at this double entendre. Although their bodies never touch, the helpless prisoners are simulating sodomy by making thrusting motions of humping. They are dismissed back to their cells as the guards retreat to their quarters, clearly feeling that they have earned their night's salary. My nightmare from last night is coming true. I'm glad that now I can control it by ending it all tomorrow. It is hard to imagine that such sexual humiliation could happen in only 5 days, when the young men all know that this is a simulated prison experiment. Moreover, initially they all recognized that the others were also college students like themselves. Given that they were all randomly assigned to play these contrasting roles, there were no inherent differences between the two categories. They all began the experience as seemingly good people. Those who were guards knew that but for the random flip of a coin, they could have been wearing the prisoner's smocks and been controlled by those they were now abusing. They also knew that the prisoners had done nothing criminally wrong to deserve their lowly status. Yet some guards have transformed into perpetrators of evil, and other guards have become passive contributors to the evil through their inaction. Still other normal, healthy young men, as prisoners, have broken down under the situational pressures, while the remaining surviving prisoners have become zombie-like followers. The power of this situation ran swiftly and deeply through most of those on this exploratory ship of human nature. Only a few were able to resist the situational temptations to yield to power and dominance while maintaining some semblance of morality and decency. Obviously, I was not among that noble class.